it's really crazy how much of the, you know, cash flow that you've accumulated over the years can go right out the door to maintenance and repairs. And I intuitively or know it, right? Like it makes sense. I think everybody's aware of it, but like it really hits you over the head when you're maybe 18 months of cash flow right there.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Parker Stone is an active investor focused on opportunistic and value-add multifamily assets. Parker, welcome to the show.
Sam, thank you. Great to be here.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you briefly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I first got interested in real estate when I started out in my first corporate job. I was, you know, so excited to get in there and, you know, meet the team and everything. And I think within the first few months, we had a huge layoff. It was tough to, you know, you always hear about, you know, layoffs happening, you know, to see it happening to you know, your mentors and people you work really close with. That was tough. So we had a layoff, and I mean, we had subsequent ones. We had, I feel like it was every other month at that point, right? So yeah, so I really, in the get-go, I was like, I need a plan. I need to execute it, and I need to do it now in order to find, you know, passive income. And you know, because I didn't want to get to the point where I was 40 years old. That was my only source of, you know, way to support my family, and then just to be let go at a moment's notice. So yeah, that's what really dragged me into real estate. You know, I have a numbers background. So I started to, you know, look at different ways that I could, you know, get into other businesses or passive income. I looked at franchises. I looked at dividend stocks. You know, I feel like I explored, you know, everything under the sun. And I just kept coming back to real estate because there's so many different ways to create value, to find arbitrage, to, you know, force appreciation. So that's what, you know, really got me into real estate. At the time, my brother was graduating from NC State down in Raleigh. And I knew from my research that was, you know, one of the top markets in the country that was growing head over shoulders every year. So when he was, during his graduation, I took a flight down there and I was like, yeah, let's go, you know, let's go walk these neighborhoods. I looked it up. I'm like, this is like a great area of growth. It's got good cash flow. And he was like, all right, like I'll tag along. So we're walking down the street and this guy sticks his head out and he's like, what are you guys doing? And we're like, oh, we're, you know, in the area. We're thinking about buying a, you know, a townhouse around here. And he's like, oh, well, my wife and I, we just bought a house. We need a bigger yard for the dog. We have to move immediately and we need to sell this place fast. So we're like, all right, let's do it. So that was the first deal. That was how we got in. And yeah, I mean, so since then, my brother and I, we bought a number of, you know, kind of, you know, the Burr strategy where force appreciate, refinance, then rent it out. We ended up doing a number of places down there.
Wow. That's so you did a bunch of single family in the Raleigh market. And then what was your next step?
Yeah. So we started doing single family, and then I was in New York at the time. Right. So I needed to constantly network and find more people down there to be able to manage these places, to be able to find more deals for us, and then, you know, be able to like finance them, you know, at the same time. Right. And, you know, being remote, you need to build a team, you need to leverage them. So I started to, you know, just get on BiggerPockets, all these different websites to, you know, find some of the top performers in Raleigh. And then we moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and, you know, other markets as well. So I started doing that. And then, you know, someone reached out to me, Chris, who's now my partner on BiggerPockets. He's like, hey, I love what you're doing down there. Let's grab a drink. I'm also in New York. So we connected, really hit it off. And I was like, yeah, you are you interested in, you know, investing in single family, kind of like what we're doing? And he said, no, I'm interested more in multifamily. And at that point, I met, you know, a number of multifamily brokers and, you know, realtors down there. And I was like, okay, well, let me go in my Rolodex. I'll see if I can connect you. So I reached out to some of my contacts that were, you know, brokers and, you know, come to find out they had a few properties that they were interested in, you know, that had some leads on. So we did a lot of work. We submitted couple of LOIs, did a ton of due diligence. None of those first deals worked out, but it was a great experience. And I really learned that we worked well together. When he said he was going to do something, I believed and I trusted it and he would go do it. And then when I said I was going to do something, same thing. So that's really how we began our partnership. And we were getting pretty discouraged with leads from brokers coming in the sense that we weren't getting a lot of leads, right? It was, you know, it's tough. It's tough to say, hey, we're new guys in the market, sell us your 100 unit, right? It's not always the easiest pitch, right? When these brokers have a lot on the line, they need to, you know, convince sellers that we are the best group to buy their asset, right? So that was a little difficult. So we ultimately ended up shifting to hiring virtual assistants. We downloaded, there's different list services out there, got a bunch of data, and then just had the virtual assistants call these owners directly to see, you know, if they'd be willing to sell to us. We didn't think that was going fast enough, so we ended up getting a dialer, something that can do like rapid calls or multiple calls. So we increased our calls from like 15 an hour to like 60, 70, 80. And again, we were targeting the Raleigh market. We both really liked it. And we got this one owner that said, hey, you know, I'm not selling this apartment complex in Raleigh, but I have this complex in Atlanta. I was formerly a limited partner on it. So just an individual that provided cash to the deal. We found out the GP, he wasn't able to get the job done. It was, you know, essentially a value add play. They were going to take a bunch of classic units, fix them up, and then get much higher rent for them.
Sure.
It come to find out the general partner at the time got halfway through and then ran out of money, and they ended up kicking him out. And now they have these individuals who only wanted to invest passively, had their own deals, had their own time, and had zero bandwidth to dedicate to this deal. So ultimately they said, you know, we can't give it away to you, but name your price. And we named a number that worked for them. And that's how we got our first multifamily down in Atlanta.
That's awesome, by the way. Good job. I mean, you know, the going through brokers, things like that, it can be, especially starting out. I mean, you have to have a team that is behind you that says, hey, look, we've closed XYZ in order to get anybody really to pay attention.
Yeah.
You haven't done a deal yourself, but it may be Parker and you and Chris are working with some other guys who say, hey, look, you know, they've closed, you know, $200 million in the last, you know, year. Okay. Well, then that's your team, but it's interesting. But when you go the route you took, I think that's brilliant. Hey, we got a list. We start calling people. Then you got somebody that wants to sell. They're not as quite concerned about, you know, cause they don't have a marketed deal. They're not dealing with a broker, and it's just a much cleaner transaction. I do want to dial in on this deal because this is an important, I think a lot of limited partners don't understand, at least not as well as I think they should, in that you can remove the general partner from the deal. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So general partners, limited partners, they are what you call equity, you know, equity partners, right? So right. They are investing a piece of, they're essentially investing a small piece into the deal, right? And, you know, it's just like a corporate company, well, not exactly, but a similar concept where, you know, if the majority of equity decides on this path forward, then that's what's going to happen. You know, if you have voting, if you can vote them out, essentially.
Right. So did you guys leave those limited partners as limited partners in the next deal? Did any of them bring cash, or did you just buy them out completely?
Yeah. You know, we discussed it internally. By the end of it, we had a pretty good rapport with some of the former limited, now, I guess, general partners. We discussed, you know, possibly assuming the loan that they had on it as well. Ultimately, we just decided it'd be cleanest to just go in, buy them out, and bring in our own group of investors. And, you know, by the way the deal was shaping up and the numbers we were looking at, we had some pretty enthusiastic responses from our side. So we ultimately didn't really have to go that route, or we had the option of that.
Right. Yeah. No, that's intriguing. Yeah. And I think the other thing that you'd probably run into there is that if you were to have some legacy limited partners come in, there's the scrutiny is going to be 100 times higher just from the negative experience they've already had.
I know. You get burned once, and then this group that you had no connection with before is promising you that they'll do a great job.
So the bar is already set higher, even if you did everything right. Like, maybe your communications were 2 days off or something. All of a sudden, any little off thing just becomes much larger than what it would be in any normal transaction. So that's probably a really clean and great way to do it. Everybody gets their money. Did those limited partners were made whole on the sale? Do you know?
My understanding is they were. It was a number of years ago. So I think the market, they bought it at a great time, right? Even though the deal didn't work out, the market was appreciating. So I think they got at least the majority of their money back. So, again, it was a win-win. We were able to help them regain some of their, financial position in it. And we got a property that's turning out to be an incredible investment for us.
Right. That's cool. So have you gone strictly to multifamily, no longer looking at anything on the single family side?
Yeah. Everybody talks about all the advantages of multifamily, better returns and whatnot. For me, it's really that it gives you the opportunity to build systems and build teams where, the overhead is the comparative overhead for a single family would be so high. It's very hard to, right. And there on one hand, you have the financial returns are typically higher in multifamily, but at the same time, I think for me, it's really rewarding to be able to build out a network, to build out, these people who become your partners, who become, ultimately like really good friends and people you can really trust on. For me, I think it's multifamily all the way forward.
Right. Understood. No, that's great. So what does the future look like for you and your real estate investing? Really, it's multifamily, but what's the end goal or what's the target currently?
Yeah, I think right now, and Sam, call me out if you don't agree with this, but I think right now the hardest thing in this market is to find deals. Raising capital is not easy. There's many parts of the business that's not easy, but it's just such a competitive cutthroat, market out there. Cap rates are compressing so much. We're really trying to do the hardest thing here to go out and find some good deals. And to that end, we brought on more virtual assistants to, not only make calls, but we're getting on brokers lists. We're making connections. We're taking broker meetings. And, with these VAs that we're bringing on, we're able to, underwrite deals much more quickly. So I like to think I have a pretty strong financial and business background, and as well as my partner. So we've created our own financial modeling to ultimately have, the single model where it's maybe like 10 or so inputs that are most critical in a deal. We trained our VAs to download data, input them for us, and then pull rental comp sheets, which, when you think about it, what's the biggest number in a multifamily P&L? It's that revenue, right? That top line. And so that can really...
Should be at least.
Should be, if you're doing it right. But so that number, if you're off by, say 5% on that number, that's going to swing it more than being 5% off on anything else. So we've been laser focused on not only finding and underwriting deals, but also like really, really understanding the market and what the upside and downside is there. So the hope is going forward, and we've begun this process where, a broker sends us a deal, we can get a pretty thorough underwriting and a pretty thorough understanding of it back to them within 24 hours. So with that added capacity, we're really aggressively, going out, finding more deals, making more contacts. And with this Noonan property, we'll be having a refinance in less than a year from now. And the majority, if not all of our investors' money should be coming back from that. So with that original cash and, hopefully if we can, get the story about Clear Bay out there and bring in more interested parties, we'll be able to go after some pretty big deals, in the back half of this year and especially first half of next year.
Right. No, that's great. I want to dial in here a little bit on your usage of VAs to underwrite. I think, that's, That's an interesting, you know, I know people do it. Clearly, I'm talking to one right now that does it. How did you set up the process such that you knew when the information they were giving to you was good?
A lot of trial and error. We use a number of different data sources. So at the very beginning, it was just writing out a step-by-step-by-step process for them. Like literally, like number one, click here to open up the document. Number two, like drag document over here, right? So almost like a process, you know, not because these individuals are, you know, like not intelligent or anything. It's just because it's, you know, you're working different time zones. You have different, you know, language barriers that might be going on. So it's just important to get this crystal clear process out. And then, you know, the first few months, they would underwrite something, we would underwrite it as well. And then we would compare numbers and say, okay, this is why, you know, this is why this number is actually, you know, a 5 cap versus like a 5.5 cap. And it's, you know, it's because it's a, you know, class B versus like class C or something like that. So it's a process like just getting out step by step, doing it with them, getting that feedback. We would have daily meetings at, you know, 5:30 our time every single day, and they would have to come with their deal, and we would, you know, go through it and, you know, clean it up, and just to make sure they were, you know, learning the process. And it was challenging. It's, you know, it's certainly not easy to manage anybody, especially manage a team and, you know, the other side of the world, but it's good. Right now we have, you know, several VAs that, you know, we can trust a lot that have been with us for, you know, the better, well, over a year. One of them actually just had their year anniversary with us at Clear Bay. So yeah, so it's, did I answer the question?
Yeah, you did. You're fine. Yeah. Yeah. It's, which was, you know, how do you train them? How do you make sure that the information they're given to you is good? Because I mean, like you said, there's a million factors. And then all of a sudden, if you're half a percentage point off, it can, you know, change the trajectory of the deal incredibly.
So yeah.
It sounds like you spent a lot of time on the front end training and really vetting, not vetting, but getting them in tune with your process. And I'm sure before you guys go to LOI, you're going to do your own kind of dry run through it anyway, just to double it.
It's, you know, no matter how automated we get it, we ultimately end up spending a good amount of time. And that might just be, you know, the nature of our group, but it's, you know, it's important. There's a lot riding on it. You know, LOIs are non-bonding, but you still have relationships with brokers and sellers. You don't want to mess up at all.
Right. Hey, sorry about my letter of intent. What I meant was one half of the amount we actually submitted. Yeah. That doesn't go.
Doesn't
go over very well on the cold call side of things. Are you guys still using VAs to do cold calling?
We are. Yeah. And we've recently started to ramp that up a bit more. It's tough. I think I was trying to go back some of the numbers to maybe share with you and your audience, but I think we made over like 10,000 calls to get the place in Atlanta. So yeah, so I mean, it's a bit of a grind too. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think I heard a stat like 95% of deals are on market, right? So that's one of the reasons why we're looking more at brokers.
Hey, understood. Man, that's super cool. And those are simple tools, you know, that you are presenting here today that helps people scale their business. But you can, as much as possible, automate underwriting, or at least take some of the burden off of it. Get the lower level tasks in that process onto somebody else's plate, and then, you know, cold calling as well. I mean, it's you know, there's an art to it. But again, if you feel confident in that process, that's great. Is there anything else technology related that you guys are using in your business right now?
Technology. We use Podio. It's a CRM. It's good to manage, you know, potential deals, brokers, capital raisers, anybody really. So we use that. We've started using Asana. Asana is a great way to kind of manage deal flow going from like OM received, or like seller contacted, to like first pass underwriting, to like LOI submitted, to like rejected or accepted. So it's been really helpful in kind of streamlining that. And then we have a Slack instance with our virtual assistants and team. And, you know, it's helpful to segment that communication, like this is deal evaluation, this is general business, this is where we're, you know, talking about schedules. Yeah, those are some of the tips and tools of the trade that we have.
Right, man, that's cool. A couple more questions here before we jump into the final four. Have there been any pitfalls or surprises so far in your real estate journey?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Probably, I mean, honestly, maybe more on the single family side. So we're both my partner and I actually we're looking at kind of liquidating some of our legacy single family portfolios and going to sell. And to get top dollar, you want to make sure that you fix up the big issues with the property, right? And it's really crazy how much of the cash flow that you've accumulated over the years can go right out the door to maintenance and repairs. And I intuitively know it, right? Like it makes sense. I think everybody's aware of it, but like it really hits you over the head when you're when you're like, oh man, that's maybe 18 months of cash flow right there.
Right. Oh gosh, yeah. Yeah, I've been there too many times. You're like, that's there went the year.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Which again, when you go back to scale, it's maybe it's not quite as painful on 50 or 100 units or 200 units when one thing goes wrong, because you got 199 others to make up for it. But when it's one of one, it gets expensive fast. Let's see. Got one other question for you. Have you received any bad advice? Have you received anything that people said, hey, this is the way you should go, and it was just not the best advice you could have?
Yeah. I've been told before, watch out for partnerships, be careful, like, it can be really dangerous. I agree. Like you definitely have to vet your partners. You have to like really understand them. But I mean, I would argue it's just as risky to, go it alone. It's a pretty rare case where the one single individual is going to beat the team working together. So yeah, I have to have a stern talking to the guy that gave me that advice.
No, that's great. That's absolutely great. Parker, let's jump here into the final four questions. The first one is this: if I were to give you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Yeah, I really like that question. I would probably go for a house hack. I think there's a good amount of ways to go about relatively low percent down, buy a duplex and rent out the other half. Mm-hmm. I think that way you'll really be able to save money, to compound it, and then ultimately like invest in other deals. I think that, and then if you have any leftover, and this is something I personally want to work on as well, but maybe use some of it to go to like networking events or put yourself in opportunities where you can meet people much smarter than you.
Right.
Because I think networking is important for anybody's development.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. Question number two is this: if you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I mean, thinking you have to do everything by yourself, there's a lot of smart, knowledgeable people that can, take what you don't want to do, whether it's, in the form of virtual assistants, whether it's in the form of partnerships that, partners that might have experience in this other area. So you can focus what you might be a rock star on. Yeah, definitely avoid that.
Right. Now that's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah. Now that we have our complex in Atlanta doing well, cash flowing, we're talking about ways that we can use some of the excess cash to create scholarships or community programs. That $1,000, $2,000 that it might not go that far when you spread it out amongst all the investors, but I think that can really mean a lot to somebody and really, help them in a meaningful way.
Right. Now that's cool, man. Parker, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah. Our website is clearbaycapital.com. My personal email is pstone@clearbaycapital.com. If they have any interest in checking out what we're calling our first pass model, please email me. They can get a beta version of it and help them underwrite their deals much more quickly.
That's awesome. Yeah. So if you want to download or if you want a copy of the first pass model that Parker is using for their underwriting, you can email pstone@clearbaycapital.com and get a copy of that underwriting model. That's really cool. Parker, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Sam, thanks so much for having me on.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.